I'm very excited tonight to welcome Celeste Ng. I've been working with her manager for publicity manager, is that what she is, forever. I've been begging her since last year. I really want Celeste to come, and I'm so honored that she is coming. She came to two libraries while she's in town. One of them was Shaker Heights that she was at last night, her hometown, and the other one is here. So I'm just really honored that she could come to Hudson, and I know you guys are all excited too because we have such a nice crowd. Celeste is the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, Everything I Never Told You, which received the APALA Award for Fiction and the YALSA Alex Award. The novel was Amazon's number one best book of 2014 and a New York Times Book Review Notable Book of 2014. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, One Story, Five Chapters, Gulf Coast, The Millions, and elsewhere, and has been awarded the Pushcart Prize. She grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in Shaker Heights, in a family of scientists, and earned an MFA from the University of Michigan. And one more note that I forgot. Afterwards, there will be a book signing and refreshments in the rotunda. In the rotunda, if you head back into, just kind of follow the crowd, head back into the library. And Celeste will be signing books, and books will be available for purchase from the Learned Owl. So without further ado, Celeste Ng.
So one thing that I've learned from doing these is that I'm really much shorter than anyone else. So I'm always just pulling the microphone down. Thank you so much, Polly, for that wonderful introduction. Thank you to the Hudson Library for having me here and to the Learned Owl for selling books. And thank you to all of you for coming. You're all here to see me? So not to put anyone on the spot, but more so that I know what to talk about. Have some of you read the book already? Okay, so actually quite a number of you read the book already. So what I'll do is, for those who haven't read the book, I'll read just a short section from the very beginning so you can kind of get a sense of what the book sounds like and what it's about. And then what I thought I'd do is tell you a little bit sort of about the inspiration behind the book and the inspiration of the characters, where all that sort of came from, so that you'll get some of the behind the scenes information about the book. I'm going to read just from the very, very first pages of the novel. So if you haven't read it, you don't really need to know anything. This is chapter 1, page 1. Lydia is dead, but they don't know this yet. 1977, May 3rd, 6:30 in the morning. No one knows anything but this innocuous fact. Lydia is late for breakfast. As always, next to her cereal bowl, her mother has placed a sharpened pencil and Lydia's physics homework, 6 problems flagged with small ticks. Driving to work, Lydia's father nudges the dial toward WXKP, Northwest Ohio's best news source, vexed by the crackles of static. On the stairs, Lydia's brother yawns, still twined in the tail end of his dream. And in her chair in the corner of the kitchen, Lydia's sister hunches, moon-eyed over her cornflakes, sucking them to pieces one by one, waiting for Lydia to appear. It's she who says, at last, "Lydia's taking a long time today." Upstairs, Marilyn opens her daughter's door and sees the bed unslept in, neat hospital corners still pleated beneath the comforter, pillows still fluffed and convex. Nothing seems out of place. Mustard-colored corduroys tangled on the floor, a single rainbow-striped sock. A row of science fair ribbons on the wall, a postcard of Einstein. Lydia's duffel bag crumpled on the floor of the closet. Lydia's green book bag slouched against her desk. Lydia's bottle of baby soft atop the dresser, a sweet, powdery, loved baby scent still in the air. But no Lydia. Marilyn closes her eyes. Maybe when she opens them, Lydia will be there, covers pulled over her head as usual, wisps of hair trailing from beneath. A grumpy lump bundled under the bedspread that she'd somehow missed before. "I was in the bathroom, Mom. I went downstairs for some water. I was lying right here all the time." Of course, when she looks, nothing has changed. The closed curtains glow like a blank television screen. Downstairs, she stops in the doorway of the kitchen, a hand on each side of the frame. Her silence says everything. "I'll check outside," she says at last. "Maybe, for some reason..." She keeps her gaze trained on the floor as she heads for the front door, as if Lydia's footprints might be crushed into the hall runner. Nath says to Hannah, "She was in her room last night. I heard her radio playing at 11:30. He stops, remembering that he had not said goodnight. Can you be kidnapped if you're 16? Hannah asks. Nath prods at his bowl with a spoon. Cornflakes wilt and sink into clouded milk. Their mother steps back into the kitchen, and for one glorious fraction of a second, Nath sighs with relief. There she is, Lydia, safe and sound. It happens sometimes. Their faces are so alike, you'd see one in the corner of your eye and mistake her for the other. The same elfish chin and high cheekbones and left cheek dimple. The same thin-shouldered build. Only the hair color is different. Lydia's ink black instead of their mother's honey blonde. Nath and Hannah take after their father. Once a woman stopped the two of them in the grocery store and asked, "Chinese?" And when they said yes, not wanting to get into halves and wholes, she'd nodded sagely. "I knew it," she said, "by the eyes." She'd tug the corner of each eye outward with a fingertip. But Lydia, defying genetics, somehow has her mother's blue eyes, and they know this is one more reason she is their mother's favorite, and their father's too. Then Lydia raises one hand to her brow and becomes his mother again. "The car's still here," she says, but Nath had known it would be. Lydia can't drive. She doesn't even have a learner's permit yet. Last week, she'd surprised them all by failing the exam, and their father wouldn't even let her sit in the driver's seat without it. Nath stirs his cereal, which has turned to sludge at the bottom of his bowl. The clock in the front hall ticks, then strikes 7:30. No one moves. "Are we still going to school today?" Hannah asks. Marilyn hesitates. Then she goes to her purse and takes out her keychain with a show of efficiency. "You've both missed the bus. Nath, take my car and drop Hannah off on your way. Then, don't worry, we'll find out what's going on." She doesn't look at either of them. Neither looks at her. I'll stop with the reading portion there, but as we, the readers, know, it doesn't turn out well. What has happened is that Lydia has drowned in the local lake, and they find her body. And this reveals a web of secrets that the family has been keeping that they're going to have to grapple with if they're going to survive this tragedy. So people often ask me about where I got the idea to write this book, often with a little element of concern in their voices. So there were two things. This sort of small plot seed that started it all is that my husband, who also grew up in the Cleveland area, told me a story about when he was about 8. He went to a friend's house, and his friend pushed his own little sister, who was 5, into the pond in the back of their house. And the parents were nearby, and they pulled her out, and she was fine. And I've met this young man, and he's grown up to be a perfectly nice person. But I kept thinking about that for some reason. I sort of thought, well, why would somebody push a girl into, you know, why would he push his sister into the lake? You know, what was their relationship like before? And then what was their relationship like after he had pushed her into the lake and she had been saved? And I started to think about this image of a girl falling into the lake. And of course, the story changed, as it always does. Lydia, the girl in my novel, is 16 when she falls into the lake. But that was where the sort of plot idea came from, that idea of a girl falling into the water. The larger sort of thematic inspiration came from my adolescence growing up in Shaker Heights on the east side of Cleveland. Shaker, as a lot of you probably know, is a really nice community. I had a really great time growing up there. It's fairly diverse, it's very progressive, it's very pretty, and I have wonderful memories of it. During the 10 years that I lived there, though, by sort of a terrible coincidence, 3 young women from the high school were actually murdered. So one of them was found stabbed on the street, one of them was shot in front of the police department, and this may, if those of you who were in the area at the time may remember some of this, one of them who had been in my class, soon after we went to college, was kidnapped and murdered by a stranger. And so that made a really big impression on me, each one individually and then the 3 of them in the aggregate. I think it's always shocking any time someone dies, but especially in these circumstances. And for me, that was sort of my first encounter with death of someone who had been around my age, you know, not someone who'd been elderly, not someone who'd been ill. And it was especially shocking because, you know, I sort of knew them and I sort of knew their families, and I knew the world they came from. or I realized I thought that I knew the world that they came from. And I started to wonder, were there things that we didn't know about? You know, how did this happen? Not that these women were in any way to blame for what happened, but was there some way that, was there something we missed that we could have, you know, picked up on to save them? And I wondered too, because I had known some of their family members, about how you keep going after a tragedy like that. How do you manage to make it through the rest of your life, because your life has to go on? And so although the novel isn't based on any of those three cases, that was sort of what got me thinking about these issues and some of the things that I wanted to write about. So there is a mystery at the heart of the book, sort of what happened to this young woman, Lydia, and how did she end up in the lake? And of course, the roots of the problem go back much deeper than it appears, as is often the case. But it's really a family story. It's really sort of a story about parents and children and their relationships and the different things that they each keep from each other and what happens when that those sorts of secrets happen in a family. So since it's a family story, let me introduce you to the different characters in the novel, and I'll take questions afterwards, so this is fair warning to think of some questions for afterwards. But this is the part where I usually say that I tell you who in my life I annoyed by stealing their personal characteristics from my characters. I used to say that the novel was not based on my family, and the characters were not my characters, because really, you know, my mother is not the mother in the book. My father is not the father in the book. And so people would say, is this based on your family? And I would say, no. And I've started to realize, actually, that that's not entirely true, that actually the characters do have their roots in my family and in me, but not in the way that we usually expect. So let me explain what I mean. So first, we have the father, James, who is a Chinese-American man. And my father, both of my parents were Chinese-American. They immigrated from Hong Kong in the 60s. And I saw, while I was growing up, some of what my father experienced as an Asian-American man. What happened was that, whether it was at work, whether it was in the neighborhood, whether it was on the street, people had certain expectations about what he would be like and how he would act and what he was supposed to be doing. And what he actually was and what he wanted to do didn't always match up with what people expected of him. And so I wanted to sort of draw on those small sort of assumptions that people often have about Asian Americans, and particularly about Asian American men. So in the novel, James is also an Asian American man, and he likes to push back on those expectations a little bit. So he's not only an Asian American man, he's a professor, and he's a professor of American history. And not only is he a professor of American history, but his special sub-interest in that field is cowboys, which many people in the novel find surprising. And James, as the father, kind of likes that. He sort of likes the idea that he's upending expectations. And so James loving cowboys in the novel was partly sort of a character trait. He's the sort of person who will push a little bit on what people think. But it was also inspired by my father, because to my sisters and my great amusement growing up, our dad was a huge John Wayne fan. This is because when he was growing up in the 50s, when he was a teenager and then in college, what they were playing in the movie theaters in Hong Kong was John Wayne movies. And so he probably saw every John Wayne movie that was out there. And apparently when he and my mother were dating in Hong Kong, his idea of a really great date was a double feature of John Wayne movies. So my mom has also seen all of the John Wayne movies that are out there. And so that's a little sort of personal tribute to my dad, the fact that James loves cowboys and in fact has his own classes watch John Wayne movies. So Marilyn, the mother, is a white woman from Virginia, as you heard in the little section that I read. This is a mixed race family. And Marilyn is really not very much like my mother at all. Marilyn in the novel is what they would have called at the time a housewife. She's at home with the children. But she was inspired by my mom, and in particular by a cookbook that my mom had, which I've brought to show you, which is this here. Also, this is what happens, that everybody has this cookbook. So this was a cookbook that my mom got soon after she came to the United States. And so this was the cookbook we had in my house growing up. And this is the cookbook that I sort of learned to cook from. This is where we got our Christmas cookie recipes. This is where my mom, for a long time, would get the chart for how long to roast the turkey at Thanksgiving. And in fact, I had to promise her that I would take very good care of this so that I could take it with me on book tour. She didn't want to give it up. So I have a lot of fond memories of this cookbook. It wasn't until I was an adult and my mother was downsizing to a condo and I came home to help her pack and to take my stuff out of her basement that I picked up the cookbook as an adult and actually started to read it and not just look at the pictures and look at the recipes. And since I have it here, I'm going to read you a few little bits of it. And if you've read the novel, some of these will sound a little familiar. So this is from the pies section. I love the 1960s photography of this cookbook. And this is what it says in the pies section. If you care about pleasing a man, bake a pie. But make sure it's a perfect pie. And then it goes on to give you pie recipes. So here's another example. This is from the eggs and cheese chapter, which in this cookbook, for some reason, are grouped together. And this is what it says under basic eggs. The man you marry will know the way he likes his eggs. And chances are he'll be fussy about them. So it behooves a good wife to know how to make an egg behave in six basic ways. And here they are with helpful hints. All right, so I'll read you one more, which is one of my favorites. This is from Preserves, Relishes, and Garnishes. And I love the 1960s color scheme of those preserves, relishes, and garnishes. And this is what the cookbook says to get you, the reader, really excited about making your own preserves, relishes, and garnishes. Betty's pickles, Aunt Alice's peach conserve, Mary's mint relish. Is there anything nicer than a gift you made yourself? Anything that gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction than a row of shining jars and glasses standing on your shelf? So there were a lot of those passages in the book, and I was sort of horrified and fascinated at the same time. And I started to think a lot about what it might have been like to be a woman, and particularly an ambitious woman, in an era where everything around you, even to your cookbook, was telling you that this was what you were supposed to want to do, and this was what you were supposed to be getting your satisfaction from. And so in the novel, Marilyn is a housewife, but she had wanted to be a doctor. She had had ambitions before. She'd been in college and had hoped to become a doctor in the 1950s, and it doesn't work out for her. She ends up getting pregnant and getting married. And at a certain point in the novel, after she's married and has some children, she finds her mother's cookbook, which is this cookbook. And she reads some of the passages, like the ones that I read to you. And that prompts her to reconsider her life and to take some pretty drastic actions that have repercussions throughout the rest of her family's life. So James and Marilyn meet and marry in the late 1950s, which I learned while I was researching the book was a time that interracial marriage was actually still illegal in certain parts of the United States, which was just sort of shock to me, especially as I'm in an interracial marriage myself right now. But it was legal in Massachusetts where they met and they married. And they have three kids. And my sister, I think, when reading this book, approached this section with a little bit of trepidation, wondering if one of them was going to be based on her. And I think to her great relief, they all were pretty much based on me. So Nath, who is the oldest child and the oldest brother, loves science. And he's growing up in the late 1960s and the early 70s, which is at the height of the space race. And so he really wants to become an astronaut. And Nath is sort of inspired by the science nerd side of me. As you heard in the introduction, I grew up in a family of scientists. My dad was a physicist. He worked at NASA, it's now NASA Glenn, but I always want to say NASA Lewis Research Center over on the west side of Cleveland. My mom is a chemist and taught chemistry and did research for many years. And my sister is a mechanical engineer. And so I got raised with a lot of science in the house and to sort of think about things in a science-y sort of way. And so Nath is sort of a science nerd like me. And moreover, I had really wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid. It seemed plausible and like a reasonable career choice at about 7 or 8. And so, of course, that didn't really work out, but letting Nath sort of have this dream of going into space travel is sort of a bit of wish fulfillment for me. But even though I came from a science-oriented family, I didn't go into science. I became a writer, which some people think of as being pretty far removed from the sciences. And this brings us to Lydia, who is the middle child, who's the favorite child, and who is also the one whose death is at the center of the book. If you remember in the section that I read, her physics homework is there at the breakfast table. Her mother has a lot of expectations about her and a lot of dreams for what she thinks her daughter might be able to accomplish. And the problem is that those don't always mesh with what Lydia herself is interested in. Lydia is the sort of child who doesn't want what her parents want, and she's sort of trying to figure out where she wants to please them and where she wants to go her own way. I've been asked a lot as I've been out talking about the book whether my parents were upset that I didn't go into science, and I was really fortunate that they were really supportive. They were readers, and although I think they would have liked me to be a scientist because they thought I would be good at it, they understood that that wasn't what I wanted to do. But Lydia in the novel is really sort of torn between what her parents expect from her and what she thinks she might want for herself. And of course, this is one of the roots of the tragedy at the center of the novel. Finally, there's Hannah, who is the youngest sister at age 10. She's sort of a secretive little girl. She's always hiding behind the furniture, around the corner, listening in on her family. This was in part inspired by my own behavior as a child because I spied on my family all the time. Harriet the Spy was one of my favorite books growing up. And so whenever my mother would put the long tablecloth on the table at Thanksgiving, I would get under there and sit there and wait for people to start saying interesting stuff. When my parents had parties, I would go upstairs and listen at the air registers in hopes that they would, you know, start dishing out juicy gossip. Because I think even as a child, I always had the idea that adults had to be leading more interesting lives than they appeared to be leading on the surface. But Harriet the Spy was actually sort of an inspiration to me, not just in the spying side, but actually on the writing side. Because if any of you have read Harriet the Spy, you know that this little girl actually wants to be a writer. And I think that there is a real connection between being nosy, let's say, and being a writer. I think that one of the things that writers do is they try to piece together a narrative. In other words, sort of a cause and effect, so that we can understand why things happen. It's a sort of natural human impulse, especially when we're confronted with a tragedy or something that we don't understand, to try and figure out why this happened. In other words, to make a narrative so that we can just wrap our minds around it. That's sort of how humans work. And so Hannah in the novel is like me as the author and like you as the reader in that she's trying to figure out what's going on. She's trying to piece together all the stories of her family members so that she can understand what's happened to her family and understand whether or not they can survive this tragedy. So for those of you who've read the novel already, I hope that you enjoyed learning some of the behind-the-scenes information about the characters. For those who haven't, I hope that I've piqued your interest. And thank you so much for coming. I'm happy to take questions afterwards, but thank you. What is my next novel is the question. The next novel has sort of been on pause while I've been on book tour. We are getting to the stage where my editor and agent will say, so, how's it going? Are you working? Right now they understand that I've been traveling. But the next novel I think is also going to be a family story, and I think it's going to be set in Shaker Heights, which is where I grew up. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Shaker Heights, but it was a really great place to grow up. But it also has a lot of quirks to it. So the example that I always give is that on garbage day, you don't put your garbage out in the front of the house. You keep it at the back. And Shaker has these tiny little garbage trucks that zip down the driveway and pick up the garbage in the back and take it out to the front. And no one believes me when I tell them this in other cities. They're like, really? And I say, yes. And they say, no, not really. And I say, no, really. There's something very sort of metaphorically rich about having to keep all of your garbage hidden away and not let anyone see it. And there are a lot of other sort of quirks like that. So the novel, I think, will be about a family that lives in Shaker and a mother and daughter who come from outside, from elsewhere, who have some secrets in their past and the ways that those families kind of get entangled and stir up some trouble for each other. Thank you. Yes? There are lots. I mean, I was a pretty voracious reader as a child. For this novel, there were a couple books that I turned to as touchstones. So one of them is Bel Canto, which is a novel by Ann Patchett. Ann Patchett is a writer that I really admire, but Bel Canto was the the first novel of hers, I think, where I went, oh, I didn't know you could do that. And so I sort of looked at that to sort of help me and write my own feedback, because I think every writer, you work by yourself for a while, and then you need to get some feedback, and you sort of say, is this working? Let me hear if you're getting out of it what I mean to put into it. So I definitely have a sort of writer's community as a support group. Thanks. Somebody in the back had a question. Yes, and then I'll come up front.
Back to the book. Can you tell us about Marilyn's mother? Mm-hmm. As a grandmother myself, I can't imagine a mother not ever talking to her only daughter or ever
So it's been interesting to me to hear sort of reactions to Marilyn and also to her mother. So Marilyn is the mother in the family, and she has a very difficult relationship with her own mother. They've never really seen eye to eye. And then when Marilyn in the 1950s meets James, her husband, who's a Chinese American, and marries him, she and her mother kind of break off relations and kind of stop talking to each other. And it's interesting to me to hear sometimes people say, I can't believe that, and then other people say, I completely believe it. And I hope that it means that, you know, the people who can't believe it have had very positive relationships in their life. So in the novel, Marilyn's mother is sort of trying to live her life according to the sort of Betty Crocker model that I showed you. Excuse me. She's a home ec teacher, and she and her daughter have very different ideas about what they want out of their lives. And when Marilyn gets married, she's actually already pregnant, and her mother clearly disapproves of the marriage and says some things to her on her wedding day that she finds unforgivable. They kind of lose contact with each other. And so I don't think actually that the mother ever knows that she has grandchildren. But I think that's one of the, again, the tragedies in the book, is that this family relationship kind of breaks and never really gets repaired. And I think for Marilyn, again, the mother in the book, she has a lot of guilt over that, even as she has anger over that. And so when her own mother passes away, a lot of things start opening up for her, because that's an issue that never got resolved. Thank you. Somebody here had a question. Yes.
I don't mean to sound Pollyannish, but the bias against Asian or that you exhibit, honestly, my kids grew up in a school in Northern Ohio, and it just didn't exist. We had wonderful people in our neighborhood and very well accepted, and I wondered if it was a regional bias.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that that you know your community was sort of integrated and welcoming. I mean, I had a great experience growing up in Shaker, which is pretty diverse. There's not a lot of Asians, but race relations are something that's very much on the community's mind. I would say, however, that even as I had a great experience growing up there, that there were definitely still times that I felt uncomfortable, whether it was because I felt it or because I was made to feel uncomfortable by others. And I really don't know any person of color living in this country who would not say that. So the sad truth is that with one exception in the novel, all of the little moments of racial tension or racial discrimination or just racial discomfort, we might call them microaggressions now, are things that have happened to me or to people that I know personally. And so, you know, for example, in the section that I read to you where the woman in the store said, oh yeah, I know, by the eyes, and then just pulled her eyes into slits. That was something that happened to me in the grocery store. You know, and so I think often that, you know, hopefully many people who are of color feel generally accepted and happy in their lives, as I did. And yet I think that the appearance of it from the outside and the appearance of it from the inside can sometimes be quite different. I hope it's certainly something that's changing, but again, I haven't yet met a single person of color who hasn't experienced some of these things or doesn't experience them on a regular basis. Yes, and then I'll come there.
My daughter is Korean, she's now Korean American, and she's at International Finance in Washington, D.C. There's not a more diverse area than Washington, D.C. And she has talked to me about the difficulty not only in finance, but it being this small Asian woman, mm-hmm. and the expectations of a certain behavior compartment capability to a small Asian woman.
Yes, this is something
my
that
son said
yeah.
is true.
This is something that I've experienced as well, and these are things that I think that, you know, are not consciously done. You know, a lot of the things that I experience, and I think the things that are in the book as well, are not necessarily meant with any malice, but there are moments that come up that remind you if you are different in any way, whether ethnicity, sexuality, if you have a physical handicap, whatever it is, that sometimes remind you of the things that make you different. And they're not always intended that way. But I also, as a small Asian woman, have encountered a number of times when other people, but especially tall white men, are really surprised if I disagree with them in any way, or if I have an opinion and state it. And I was in fact told by a coworker once where he said, oh, well, you're just not afraid to say your opinions, and I kind of expected that you would be more timid. And I said, here I am. So it's, I think a lot of times these things are not conscious, but they are things that if you're not aware of them, you know, can go by. Somebody over here had a question. Yes, here, and then I'll go a couple rows back. So the question is, what is the deal, I guess, with the pronouns in the title? Everything I Never Told You. So the title came from one of the last lines in the book. It's fairly close to the end. It's an echo of something that one of the characters thinks. And titles are always really hard for me. I often get title help from my friends, my writing group. But this title I came up with myself, and I liked it because it struck me that this was something that almost any of the characters might be able to say to any of the other characters. There are all ways in which these characters are staying silent. And I liked also that the title, Everything I Never Told You, could sort of cut in two ways. It could first be about the things that people keep silent about on purpose, that they don't say because they are ashamed or they are embarrassed or they are afraid to say them. But it could also refer to the things that people don't say because they don't realize other people want to hear them. And so the cliche example for that is, I love you, or I'm proud of you. Things that we often sort of let go unsaid, thinking that they go without saying. And yet, people really like to hear those things, and it really means a lot to have those words spoken. So that's sort of where the title was, and that was where I hit on the title and felt that it might work well. Somebody a couple rows back. Yes, and then I'll come over to this side. Yes. Oh, thank you.
And one of the really interesting tensions that we spent a lot of time talking about was, and I'm sorry, quasi-spoiler alert, so if you want to add your ears, was the tension in the mutually exclusive goals that the parents had for the kids, fit in, stand out.
I don't think that's too much of a spoiler, if that's okay. Sure. So the question is about sort of the different. I don't know that they're necessarily mutually exclusive, but they're very different expectations that the different parents have of their children. I think one of the things that happens that I'm realizing now that I'm a parent is that when you're a parent, I think if you liked the way your life went, or if you like certain things about your life, you hope that your child will get those things, if not better. And if you weren't happy about the way that your life went, or if there are things that you felt were missing, you often want to provide those things for your child. You want to fill in any sort of deficits that you feel like you had when you were growing up. And I think at the same time, as you know, if you're thinking about it from the child's point of view, you go a lot of your life either wanting to be just like your parents or wanting to be completely the opposite of your parents. And what usually happens is you turn into your parents anyway in ways that you didn't expect. I'm simultaneously turning into both my mother and my father, and again, not in the ways that I expected at all. And so in the novel, Marilyn had these ambitions for a career and to go into medicine, and there are things that she now hopes that her daughter in the 70s, when these things are much more possible, will be able to do. James, on the other hand, growing up as an Asian American in places where there were not very many Asians, has always felt that he was sort of a social outsider, and he really wants his daughter to sort of not have that same sort of outsider experience. And the problem is that, as you sort of suggested, those things sort of run into each other. They don't have to, but often they do. And that's part of what Lydia in the novel is sort of wrestling with, and what the parents are wrestling with in terms of what sort of expectations they might have been putting on her. Advertently or inadvertently. Thank you. All right, I promised I would come to this side. Yes, and then I'll come to the back.
How long did it take you to write the novel, and how long did it take you to get it published?
So the question is, how long did it take to write and how long did it take to get published? It took me 6 years to write the novel. I started it in 2006 and my agent submitted it to publishers in November of 2012. I think that's right. So it took a long time and I went through four drafts and the drafts were quite different. The story itself stayed the same, but the structure of the novel and the way that it was told changed a lot. I was trying to experiment a lot and find the best way to tell the story. Once it was sent to the publisher, that process actually happened very quickly. Then I was very lucky in that respect. A lot of times writers will be waiting for months to hear from publishers, and in my case, I think my agent submitted the novel on the Friday before Thanksgiving. By the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, she had already gotten a lot of interest from editors who had read the book. And then by the following Wednesday, the book had, as they say, gone to auction, meaning she told them, okay, give me your bids and we'll pick someone. And so for me, the process took a little under 2 weeks, and that was kind of mind-boggling. And that's all credit for that is due to my agent in picking editors who got the book. And then once the book was accepted, there's always sort of a lag in the publishing process. They do edits, they do copy edits, they have to typeset the book, they have to design a cover. And so it took about 2 years after that for it to come out. Right. Yes, back there.
You haven't mentioned the other boy in the story either. What was
Jack.
Okay,
so the question is about Jack, who we didn't see in this little excerpt that I read. When I read longer excerpts, I actually read a section with Jack because he's one of my favorites. So Jack is the neighbor boy, and he's sort of the neighborhood bad boy. He's at school with both of the older children in the family. You know, he smokes, and he runs around a lot, and he cuts school. Lydia's older brother, is sort of very suspicious of him. And he's wondering if he was a bad influence on Lydia, because in the months before Lydia disappears, she and Jack have started spending a lot of time together. Jack was a character who I didn't know was going to be in the story at the beginning, as odd as that sounds. I thought that I was writing about a nuclear family, and I would write about the family, and this neighbor boy kept showing up in the pages. These are the things that writers say that make us sound a little weird, but that was sort of what happened, that the family was at the funeral, and I was writing the funeral scene, and this neighbor boy kept showing up. And then I would write about the children when they were younger, and this neighbor boy would show up again. And so I was trying to figure out why this boy was in the story. You know, why was my brain putting him in there? And I found out that he does have something to do with the story, and he is, you know, he does have something to do with what happened to Lydia. I will not say any more because I know some of you haven't read it, but that's where Jack came from. Somebody had a question over here? Yes, in the back, and then I'll come to the gentleman. Yes.
Our club writing, we loved the book. We all ended up feeling very sorry for Hannah. She seemed to be ignored.
Yeah, so the question is sort of why was I so mean to Hannah in the book? I guess is the underlying question there. So Hannah is also one of my favorite characters. As I said, she's sort of based on me, but she, as the youngest child, she's sort of overlooked in the family. Lydia is really the favorite, and Hannah, as the second girl, is almost sort of superfluous. But Hannah is a character who sees much more than the other characters do. She's actually listening when other people are not listening, and she's hearing what other people are sometimes not saying. And so in a lot of ways, she's much more perceptive than the other members of her family are. Because she's so young, she can't necessarily put together all the things that she has, but she can see a lot farther than they do. And in some ways, the novel is about her struggle to sort of be seen and be recognized by her family. That's why I was so mean to Hannah. You had a question, and then I'll come to the back. Yes, gentleman in the gray shirt.
Yeah, Hannah, she didn't speak up. She knew about Lydia going to the lake, and then, of course, with Lydia, what concerned me was not a suicide, and they thought that maybe it was.
So we're going to not spoil the book for other people. So one of the questions, well, here's the thing, that a lot of people have asked me questions about what happens to Lydia. And I will tell you, despite what the gentleman said, that people have very divergent opinions on what happens at the end of the book and how they interpret it. which was a surprise to me because I had an opinion myself. But what I found is that people will often come up to me and say, okay, I want to talk to you about the last part of the book. And I want to talk to you about, like, what happened to Lydia right before she went into the lake and what exactly, you know, and they'll talk to me about it. And what I find is that people have very divergent opinions about it and that they're not actually asking me what happened. What really tends to happen is that they are pretty sure that they already know what happened and they would just like me to tell them that they are right and that their friends who disagreed with them are wrong. So there's that at the end of the book. It's Ann Patchett, again, who's a writer that I admire. I got to meet a couple months ago because she was in Boston giving the Penn Hemingway Awards, and I got to introduce her, which was amazing. But she has said that people often ask her to explain parts of the book or to explain the ending of the book, and what she says is, Your relationship as the writer, your relationship with the book ends when the book goes out into the world, and you have to let the reader form their own relationship with the book, and not try and step in and explain. You have to sort of let them, you know, form their own relationship and work out what is happening. And it is not your role, and in fact, is bad for the reader's relationship with the book if you jump in and explain. So I'll leave it at that. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's such a nice thing to say. So the question is sort of, is this book available for high schools? I hadn't thought about it because writing the book, I had thought about it as adult literature. But I was really thrilled that it won the Alex Award, which is an award that the ALA, I think the American Library Association, gives, the same organization that gives the Caldecotts and the Newbery, thank you. This is an award that they give to adult literature that has an appeal to teens. And so I was really thrilled. I was really thrilled that they recognized it as such. And I've started to hear, actually, people will email me or write to me through my website, that they're high school teachers and they're starting to teach the book, and it seems like the students respond really well to it. And likewise, I've gotten emails from readers who are reading it in high school on their own, or college students who say, you know, I feel like this is opening things up, you know, this is making me rethink my relationship with my parents, which is a huge compliment. So I hope that that's something that schools maybe will be interested in doing. The schools that have done it so far seem to have had a good response to it. Yes, in the back. What's the second part of the question?
The second part of the question is, have you read The Dead Key, which is from another Shaker Heights?
Oh, okay. No, so the second part is easy. I have not read The Dead Key, but I will look it up. So the first question, which is it more common to have a very favorite child among Asian American families than among, let's say, non-Asian American families? I don't think so. I am really surprised to the extent to which some families, and I haven't seen any sort of correlation based on ethnicity, will sometimes have a favorite child. I started thinking about this question of the favorite child when I was talking with a coworker about her family, and she was one of three. She was the oldest, and then she had a brother and a sister. And at some point, a visitor to her house had asked the parents if they had a favorite child. And the parents had favorite children, and they whispered quietly to this guest which ones, and they actually had the same favorite child for different reasons. And I thought about this, and my friend kind of didn't seem to be bothered by it, but I was bothered by it. And I started thinking, well, did my parents have a favorite child? And I thought about it, and I think if they did, they hid it well enough that I couldn't see it. Maybe my sister would have a different answer. But I thought a lot about what it might be like to have a favorite child, and especially if everybody knew it. Because I've definitely seen families in which there was a favorite and everybody knew it. The favorite knew, and the other kids knew that they were not the favorite. My husband, for example, had an employer who was a lovely man, and he had four children. And they used to joke that they would send out Christmas letters with their updates about their children, Nan, 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 and Nan, because the only one that he ever talked about was the favorite. And I think that's one of the, I only have one child right now, so it's easy for me to have a favorite. But, you know, if I have another child, I think it would be hard because your children are separate people, and you will have different relationships with each of them. And it doesn't mean that one is necessarily favorite, but it might turn out that way. So I think that this is really sort of a human problem. I think anytime we're presented with more than one alternative, two or more, we're always asked to choose which one you like better. I notice this even with very small children, that, you know, you give them two things and you say, well, which one do you like better? We're always being asked to make a hierarchy. And so I think that it's, I think it's just as much of a problem for all cultures, for sure. I think maybe we have time for like one more question. Yes. So the question is, did I send the manuscript to publishers or did I start right away with an agent? I was very fortunate that I happened to meet up with my agent pretty early in the process, which is a little bit unusual. The usual process for fiction writers is that you write the whole book and you revise it and you spend probably a number of years on it, and then you approach agents and hope that one of them will want to represent this book that you already spent several years writing. And a lot of people don't, and so those years are just gone. I was very fortunate that I happened to find my agent, or rather she found me, pretty early. I had published some short stories and she saw them. We had met before, but she saw them and got in touch and said, what are you working on? And I talked to a few other agents, but she seemed to get the project. And so I signed up with her when I had only probably about 70 pages of the novel, which were different than the first 70 pages of this book. And so that was, for her, a leap of faith. And then she waited very patiently for about 6 years until I finished the book. So for me, I had the agent first, and so she was already in place when I went to work with the publishers. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming.